support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway.
From the NBC Newsroom in New York, President Roosevelt said in a statement today that the Japanese have attacked the Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, from the air. This bulletin came to you from the NBC Newsroom in New York.
This is KGU in Honolulu, Hawaii.
Life throughout America, and most poignantly in the Hawaiian Islands, was jarringly transformed in one day, the day of the bombing of Pearl Harbor, Sunday, December 7th, 1941. War was declared by President Roosevelt.
A date which will live in infamy.
Martial law was declared throughout the Hawaiian Islands and remained in effect throughout the war. All photographs were censored. Liquor was rationed, a 10 p.m. curfew was imposed, and remained in effect until the latter days of the war. Blackouts were enforced by wardens, car headlights were masked, and streetlights and stoplights went dark, and gossip and rumors quickly spread like wildfire. The fear of a Japanese invasion and takeover of Hawaii in the early days of the war was so palpable that orders were issued requiring everyone to turn in all of their U.S. currency at island banks in exchange for Hawaiian war money, and gas masks were issued to every resident. I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer reporting from Oahu, Hawaii. Come along and join me for a visit with Bishop Museum historian DeSoto Brown as he recalls his 30 years of research about life in Hawaii and on the island of Oahu during World War II. DeSoto Brown.
Hi, nice to see you.
You too. Word got to me before I met you that you authored a book about people in World War II in Hawaii. Tell us about what you learned in your interviews and the research.
Well, I had always been interested in World War II, and I think the reason was that my parents and all of their friends were all young adults at the time of the war. I'm from here. They had all been here. All of the members of my family had been here on Oahu at the time, on December 7th, 1941. As a kid, I often heard the phrase, oh, well, during the war, do you remember how such and such? And that's one of the things that kind of intrigued me about it. And in the 1980s, I decided that what I really wanted to do, having already written several books, I wanted to do one on World War II in Hawaii, but I wanted to focus more on the civilian experience or the day-to-day experience because the battles had been covered very extensively. The Pearl Harbor attack analyzed very minutely, and everything about the statistics of this many ships, this many planes, this many casualties. I wanted to approach it from the standpoint of what was daily life like? What were the restrictions? What could you do? What couldn't you do? And so forth. So that's what spurred me to do the research that I did. And the book is no longer in print, unfortunately, but it is primarily a photograph book. It's primarily an illustrated book because I believe that photographs can be very helpful, can be very powerful in what they can show you that words don't necessarily do in exactly the same way.
Especially in a familial context.
Absolutely. So the book is primarily photographs, but with explanatory text, obviously. And I did a lot of research for the photographs, not only here in the Hawaiian Islands, but I also went to Washington, D.C. to get photos from the U.S. government in various forms. And that is a very interesting part of the story because as soon as Pearl Harbor was attacked, within just a few hours, martial law was declared, and the Hawaiian Islands were under martial law for a period of years. Normally, martial law in the United States lasts for maybe just a short period of time during a natural disaster. Well, here, and that is a very complicated story as to why it occurred, once the military government became entrenched, it didn't want to let anything get given up. It was essentially a military dictatorship. Well, the result was that, among other things, all photographs were censored. All amateur pictures or professional pictures, they had to get sent to be processed at the central Kodak processing plant in Honolulu. And once they were processed, censors looked at them, and if something was considered censorable, they just didn't give the photograph back.
You're talking about people in neighborhoods,
absolutely,
family,
absolutely,
photographs.
And one of the things that was prohibited was any picture of barbed wire. Well, every coastline had barbed wire on it. So if you had barbed wire in your picture, even if it was a picture of your family at the beach, they could keep it, and you could never get it back. So that meant that most of the pictures that weren't censored, the newspapers were allowed to have more leeway in that. But basically, it was military photographers who were the only ones who could take pictures of all different kinds of stuff. So to look at those pictures, you got to go to the military sources and find them. And that of itself is an interesting story.
One of the enigmas in my mind, and people that ask me about World War II in Hawaii and Oahu specifically, has to do with the citizens who were Japanese, who were very loyal, you know, very Americanized, and their story. Did you dig deep there?
Well, one of the really fascinating aspects of World War II here versus World War II in continental U.S. is, in the continental United States, everybody who was ethnically Japanese was put into a camp. That was because they were a small minority of people. Here in the Hawaiian Islands, the Japanese, ethnically Japanese group of citizens were almost 40% of the population. So even though Hawaii was literally on the front lines and much closer to the action of the Pacific War, it wasn't possible to incarcerate every single person who was Japanese.
See, the presumption, especially people on the West Coast, assume that everybody, like in the coastal California, every Japanese was rounded up and taken to an internment camp. Even there were internment camps here, but that wasn't the operative. A little more depth on that.
Well, it was not possible to take 40% of the population out of circulation. You can't have a functioning economy if that's the case. It was also not impossible to physically bring here the necessary material to build camps for all of those people. And even if you could do that, there wasn't the space to build the camps. So logistically, it just wasn't possible to do it. So the next other alternative, which was put into effect, was everybody, regardless of ethnicity, was put under very strict control. So there was a curfew every single night for the entire war, starting on December 7th and ending in the summer of 1945.
All the islands, every island.
Everybody. And that means no civilian was allowed to go out at night unless you had a pass that you got ahead of time.
So nightlife in downtown Honolulu sucked.
There was no nightlife. There was no nightlife. And it gradually, the curfew hour was extended to 10 p.m., but that was it. Liquor was under very strict control, too, so you weren't partying it up all the time. And even if it was rationed, but it wasn't even easy to find it. So even if you had the ability, I mean, if you had the ration ability to find it, it wasn't for sale. Not only that, but the major, I mean, of course, there were restaurants and bars still functioning. But
I imagine that bootlegging would have happened.
There was some level of bootlegging, but certainly not as had been during Prohibition when they'd been very active. There was instead a local liquor industry that was created in which there was one company in particular called Five Islands Gin. They also made what was called imitation whiskey, and that was for sale, and everybody hated it. The interesting thing was, because it was very difficult to get bottles, they had to reuse whatever bottles they could get locally that had been used for other products. So they legally were allowed to use things like Clorox bottles and bottles for all kinds of stuff that they put their label on, and the label said, this is only being allowed because of emergency situation, and it's only, this is what, you know, this is gin or whiskey. It's not whatever else the bottle says.
Talk to us about some other changes in people's daily lives here. This is fascinating.
Well, one thing that was very different, and it's interesting, the Hawaiian Islands were considered almost part of the front, which meant that, unlike the rest of the U.S., a lot of things were not rationed. So while in the rest of the country there was rationing of clothes and shoes and sugar and all different types of food, here we didn't have food rationing. Our only rationing was gasoline, rubber tires, and alcohol. Everything else, theoretically, wasn't rationed. But that didn't mean you could find it, because shipping was very erratic. And most of what was being shipped was military-related. So it was very hard to find all kinds of very everyday things like paint or a fountain pen or cosmetics or zippers or anything. All of those things were difficult to find, but even more so here. And whenever a convoy was seen on the ocean coming to town, the rumors would spread, oh, there's a convoy coming, maybe they'll have liquor, maybe there'll be some shipments of things like that. It was also, as I said, because of the curfew, so suddenly you can't go to the movies at night, and you can't go out at night, and you are stuck at home. There was also a very very, very strict blackout, particularly right at the beginning of the war. And the blackout wardens were notoriously difficult and nitpicky. And so things like a cigarette or a gas burner on a stove or a radio dial, if a warden saw that, you could be arrested. Because it was martial law, if you were arrested for anything, you were taken before a military judge, even if you were a civilian. And the military judge was not necessarily somebody with any judicial training. It was purely just a military officer. And the military officer immediately on the spot could say, you're guilty, here's the fine, here's the incarceration, here's whatever, boom, on to the next person. And that's an astonishing thing for American citizens to live under a situation like that. And that went on for years. You couldn't drive very far, but it wasn't so much that gasoline was in short supply, it was rubber. The tires or the cars were the problem, because the rubber all at that point was natural rubber. It wasn't synthetic rubber made from petroleum. So the rubber was all grown in Southeast Asia, and that was where the Japanese had taken over, in Malaya in particular. So that meant that there wasn't any rubber coming into the United States. Therefore, you couldn't get tires. Therefore, you couldn't drive. So gasoline was rationed to keep you from driving, and there were also speed limits too. And so your world was very much more confined. If you had a job that allowed you to be out at night, for example, if you worked at Pearl Harbor, that meant that you could drive around at night legally, but because of the blackout, there were no street lights, there were no traffic lights. Your car had its headlights painted mostly black with a little hood over them as well. You couldn't see anything. So if you did have to drive at night, it was a terrifying experience because you couldn't see what you were doing or where you were going. At the beginning of the war, if you were out on the streets, even if you were permitted to do so, you could be shot because there were people patrolling and they were just thinking, hey, there could be saboteurs out here, let's shoot first. The military also during World War II in Hawaii, because of martial law, had the ability to just seize property or buildings if it felt like it. And literally, people could just come up to the door and say, we're taking this building, we're taking this property, you have X number of hours to get out. Usually it wasn't that abrupt, but they were able to just literally condemn land that they wanted, kick people out. The most notorious situation was Punahou School, which is a very large campus, which had several thousand students. And on the night of December 8th, hours after the attack on December 7th, a convoy of trucks arrived at the school and just drove in and said, we're taking over. And within the next few days, everybody had to rush to the school who worked there to try to save papers and books and everything else, because for the rest of the war, that was used by the U.S. military. So that level of control and that level of civilians being pushed around is something that some people were very accepting of, but others became very angry about and felt very violated. And wait a minute, you're supposed to be doing this. The civilians are the people who control the government, not the military. And yet, it's the other way around, and we don't like it.
I interviewed a woman that worked at the Bank of Hawaii, and that's where I first learned that they confiscated all United States money.
Yes.
Currency.
Yes.
You had to go to the bank and turn your money in. And talk about the strike over Hawaiian war currency. Very few people know that.
Exactly. Well, if the Japanese, I mean, right after the Pearl Harbor attack, it was not known if the Japanese were going to try to attack again, and it was not known if they were going to try to attack and physically take over and occupy the Hawaiian Islands. And fortunately for everybody here, the Battle of Midway in June of 1942 stopped the Japanese expansion. But initially, it wasn't known if that might happen or not. So had the Japanese taken over, they would have been able to seize all this tremendous amount of United States currency, which could have caused chaos for the United States economically. So it was decided that all existing currency in the Hawaiian Islands, paper currency, was going to be withdrawn. So first of all, every civilian, every business, every civilian was told you can only keep $200 in cash on your person or in your house. Everything else has got to be taken to a bank. And one of the people that I interviewed for doing my book was a woman who was my godmother, and she had worked at a bank at that time period. And she said, people came in with this horrible, dirty money that had been buried. It had been eaten by rats. It was filthy because people had been hiding it away in different places. They brought it in, and then they had in turn, they were given special currency, paper currency, that had the word Hawaii printed on both sides of it. And that currency was all you could use here legally. You could not use unprinted currency during the war. And it was not, at the end of the war, it was possible to keep it in circulation. It was, once the war had ended, it was no, it didn't have to be turned back in. And gradually it would have been taken out of circulation as it was damaged. And of course, a lot of people saved it as a war souvenir. Because of that, that would have enabled, if had the Japanese seized that currency, it would have been able to be deemed worthless, and it couldn't disrupt the rest of the United States economy. Well, they had to burn all that paper money. And at first, they went to the Oahu Cemetery crematorium and tried to burn it there, and there was just way too much of it. So they ended up going to a sugar plantation factory, a mill, which, of course, burned raw material to run the steam power to crush the cane, et cetera. So they burned the money instead of burning other types of flammable stuff, and that's where that all went up in flames. And you can imagine some of that money must have been collectible at the time, but you know they weren't going to risk trying to save it and send it back to the USA, so it got burned up.
In the hours after the attack on Pearl Harbor, the rumors and the fear ran rampant. I know that woman I told you about that worked at Bank of Hawaii in Hilo. Her dad was one of the head civilian administrators there. His report he got from Honolulu the day after Pearl Harbor was that the Japanese had landed, mm-hmm. and their uniforms were described.
Yes.
So that's the fear that the people on the Big Island were living with. Tell us about that dynamic.
Well, because the attack was such a tremendous shock and surprise. And I have to back up a little bit and say, yes, it was a shock and surprise, and nobody believed it when they first saw it because it was so unbelievable. But in fact, it had been discussed for years. The potential had been discussed for years. There had been a great deal of planning throughout 1940 and 41 for this, should it happen. They had had practice blackouts three times, 1939, 40, and 41. So on one hand, there'd been a lot of preparation, but on the other hand, when it actually happened, everybody was absolutely stunned and in shock. The radio stations were forced off the air, so there was no civilian radio to be broadcasting any type of news or information.
And that's because the Japanese aircraft could use it as a direction finder, correct?
That's exactly right. So that's why it stopped. So there were no commercial civilian radio broadcasts for a week after Pearl Harbor attack. So all the information you're getting is either what's printed in the newspapers or what people are repeating verbally. So because this is such a shock, and nobody knows what's happened, and nobody knows where the Japanese are, and are they on ships that are just right offshore, etc. Crazy, crazy rumors got started. And unfortunately, some of them got printed in the newspaper, but also they were just repeated. So yes, there was the statement of, yes, parachutists have landed, and they are wearing blue jumpsuits with a red insignia on the shoulder, or something like that. Oh, the water supply has been poisoned. You have to boil your water. Well, boiling water was not going to take poison out of the water, but that was something that was officially told.
So there was literal fear in the islands.
Sure, absolutely. And as well, too, there was this great fear of, well, there must be saboteurs here. There have got to be what we're called fifth columnists. There have to be people who were doing advance information for the Japanese government in order for them to have pulled off this attack. Therefore, they're among us and they are masquerading as civilians, but they're probably around us all the time, and so you can't talk about things, and maybe they're trying to... Just this fear, the panic, and the lack of authoritative information to counteract that meant that people were repeating crazy rumors and believing them, too. There were internment camps here in the Hawaiian Islands, and they were on Oahu. However, it was only approximately 1,200, 1,500 people, Japanese people, who were interned here. And they were people who had been identified even before the war as the ones who would be picked up, because not only were they probably Japanese citizens, but they were also the leaders of the Japanese community. And it was, I'm sure the idea was that if you take away those leaders who can't provide leadership anymore, you can then take over that leadership if they're doing something that is related to, they're urging people to commit sabotage, which none of them were.
So it wasn't that they were necessarily pro-imperial Japanese at all. They were just community leaders.
Absolutely, that is exactly right. And they may have been entirely pro-American, but if we take them away, if we get them under control, we can lead the Japanese people and we can deprive them of the ones who might be speaking and telling them what to do.
For those Japanese that had a very uncomfortable time living through World War II in Hawaii, how long did it take for that healing process to go on after the war?
You know, I think that the healing process actually got started even during the war. And one of the fascinating things is when you read about what happened with men in the military who came here from the other parts of the United States, who found that there were Japanese people walking around all over the place, and who yet nonetheless were still looking at young Japanese women and saying, hey, look how pretty they are, look how sexy they are, who got to be friends with Japanese people who they encountered in businesses and just in their daily activities outside of their military things. They realized, you know, these people are just humans like us, and they talk like us, and I don't necessarily have to hate them. That doesn't mean that there wasn't any hatred or suspicion, because there was. But at the same time, I think those personal interactions made a great deal of difference when you may think you're prejudiced against everybody. If you're actually interacting with them, it's probably that prejudice is going to go away, or at least be rethought.
Very cool. Let's dig a little deeper on that. How did they live throughout the war? How were they treated? How were they accepted?
I think for the most part, first of all, the Japanese in Hawaii consisted of people first who were Japanese citizens from Japan. Those would have been the older people. The younger people were mostly who were born here, were in a strange situation because immediately upon birth, they were considered both Japanese and American citizens. And their parents had to physically go to the Japanese consulate to renounce their children's Japanese citizenship. If they did not do so, they were considered Japanese citizens as well. And there were situations where locally born young men went to Japan to go to college, and they got drafted into the Japanese Army or Navy because they were considered Japanese citizens.
They were there when they went to war.
Exactly. So, and this was even before that, too, because Japan was already fighting China for years at that point, and there were sometimes men who were drafted into the Army to fight in China who are actually American citizens. So you've got most people who are younger who are already American. They're very Americanized. They speak English. They are totally immersed in American culture. They follow the big bands, they like movie stars and all of that business. So they were the ones feeling it even more strongly because they felt patriotic towards the United States. They considered themselves American. Immediately after the attack, all of the Japanese, ethnically Japanese young men in the Hawaii National Guard were kicked out because, well, we can't trust you. You're Japanese. There was worry. There was, on the part of non-Japanese people, there was worry. There was some suspicion. The Japanese people themselves were, of course, initially very threatened, very scared, upset, confused, angry at Japan for doing this to them, essentially. And one group of young men, because they had been released from service in the National Guard, got together and created something called the Varsity Victory Volunteers, in which they went out and did these patriotic chores to show how patriotic they were. And it was not until the summer or 1943 that ethnic Japanese men were allowed to enlist in the Army. And of course, then they did so in great quantities, and they were put into the 100th Battalion and the 442nd, and went on to great acclaim in battles, particularly in Europe. Older Japanese, in many cases, made some drastic changes in the way they lived. Everybody felt nervous, and a lot of ethnically Japanese things in homes were intentionally destroyed, burned, buried. If you had a picture of the emperor in your home, for example, just because that's what a lot of people did, or in Japanese language schools, those were destroyed. Japanese language schools, there had been great many of those for younger Japanese who went to those schools in the afternoon after their regular public school hours. Those were all immediately shut down. The Japanese language newspapers had to start printing in English in addition to Japanese, and they had to adopt, obviously, a very pro-patriotic, pro-American attitude. The older Japanese women in particular, who had still been wearing kimonos as part of their daily attire, immediately stopped and just wore Western-style clothing. There was an active urge for people to learn to speak English if they didn't speak English well. And they were also urged, again, to, for example, not have store signs in Japanese because that didn't look patriotic. So those signs were removed. Businesses were renamed. People also changed their last names. If they had any other ethnicity in their background, if they were part Japanese, thousands of people changed their names from their Japanese name to their non-Japanese name.
It might be Filipino. Or
it could be Filipino, could be an English name, it could be a Hawaiian name, it could be anything that wasn't of other ethnicity. People said, we're not going to be called Tomashiro anymore, we're going to be called Smith, because that's we're not as the object of suspicion or anger.
In the process of doing your book, what were some of the other most fascinating things that you stumbled on?
There were a whole bunch of things that I didn't know about or that were amazing. One of the things that's really quite astonishing in retrospect is prostitution. Prostitution in Hawaii was illegal before and during World War II, and yet it had been officially accepted and tolerated primarily through concentrating it into certain red light districts in Honolulu or in other places. Everybody just sort of turned away from it and pretended it wasn't happening. During the war, because of the huge amount of military men who were here, and because Hawaii was under martial law, the military government, in collusion with the Honolulu Police Department, actually oversaw the functioning of the houses of prostitution in downtown Honolulu. The military, brought the women in and out from continental USA to serve as prostitutes. And the fascinating thing was that everybody knew this was going on. There would be lines of men on the sidewalks in downtown Honolulu waiting to get into whorehouses that everybody saw, because you had to go downtown to go shopping. And one of the things that I heard from a number of people who were children then, saying, they would say, "What are all those men standing in line for?" And their mother or father has to say something like, "Oh, they're going to a movie," or something like that. There finally was a public outcry to the point where the houses of prostitution were all closed down in September of 1944. And then after that happened, there was kind of a backlash of, "Oh my God, what's going to happen now? All these sex-starved military guys are going to be assaulting and raping civilian women." And that was a very strong rumor and fear. And I asked my mother, who had been a young woman at that time, if she remembered that. And she said, "No, we were so young, we weren't paying attention to things like that. We didn't know about things like that." And then she said, "Well, if I had to drive anywhere at night, I had a gun on the seat next to me in the car." And I said, "You drove around with a gun in the car?" And she said, "Oh, yes, but it wasn't loaded." Like, oh, that makes it okay. So yes, in fact, she had been very aware of the whole thing, even though she didn't remember that she had. It was fascinating also, too, that at that time, the military was very upfront about sex and saying, "We will give out condoms." They had what were called health stations or pro stations. And I've seen a picture of one in downtown Honolulu for Navy men. You just went in and could get a condom. And then they had this whole treatment thing, because there were no antibiotic treatments for venereal diseases yet, which were the big fear. So there was this whole thing like, okay, if you've had sex, come in and tell us, and we're gonna treat you for it. It was very open, as opposed to in later years. I mean, today it's act as though, no, you just won't do it. Well, that doesn't really help. But it's remarkable to think that in the 40s, they were actually more forward-thinking than people are today.
Very interesting.
Yeah. No, it's fascinating. And there were so many things about the differences of World War II that, since I had not personally experienced them, I may have known about them sort of intellectually, but when I really delved into it and really thought about it and thought, what would it be like to live through that? What would it be like to every single night of your life have to be in your house at 6 o'clock at night as soon as the sun went down and no lights showing? I mean, that means that you can't do anything at night. If you can't turn lights on, everybody just goes to bed. It's a totally huge different change in your lifestyle, and you become accustomed to it, and then after a while you don't think about it anymore. But if you think about it today, those constraints are really astonishing to think about.
It seems that some businesses probably went bankrupt, where others really thrived and did great.
Yeah, and tourism is a major example of that, because tourism, while it was not the foundation of the local economy that it is today, was still a very important part of it. And tourism came to an absolute complete dead stop because the Navy took over all the ships, all of the large passenger ships. So these,
a lot of the hotels too, right?
Well, they took over the Royal Hawaiian Hotel. And so the other hotels continued to function,
but they were
much smaller. So the Royal Hawaiian is the biggest hotel, and all the big ships owned by Matson, which bring hundreds of people every time they come, are out of service.
They became troop transports,
They became
right?
troop transport ships, and not only that, tourism was prohibited anyway. You couldn't just go buy a ticket because you wanted to go on a nice tour. You just couldn't do it. So that meant that every tourist-related business suddenly is not functioning anymore. But what did happen as time passed during the war was so many military guys were coming in that you sold souvenirs to them. You did hula presentations to them. they took the place and more of tourism. So there was a whole small cottage industry grew up to make souvenirs to sell to guys in the military. And as I said, there were hula shows too. I mean, a lot of those were done just through the USO for free. But again, you've got a whole new audience. And another side industry that appeared was taking photos of guys with hula girls, or I should say, a young woman usually wearing a hula outfit or just dressed in attractively, that men would line up to and pay 50 cents for a photograph. And essentially, they were just paying 50 cents so that they could put their arms around and maybe kiss this young woman. And by the way, a photo is being taken, and then you get to pay for your photograph. And huge numbers of those photographs were taken, and they still exist now that so many of the World War II participants are dying. Their possessions from that time period are coming onto the market. And so you are able to find lots and lots of photographs taken during World War II by men, collected by men who were here. And they mean nothing to the survivors because the survivors weren't here. And so those come onto the market, for which I'm grateful, because now I can purchase those for my personal collection to have as mementos of World War II. And as I said, many of them are these young guys embracing and kissing and groping, unfortunately, women having their picture taken.
Since your book that you did is a visual book, a photographically driven book, you can't talk to the people in the photos. So as you looked at them, you were traveling back in time, and you had to kind of breathe life and animation into that moment in time. Tell us about some of the visual journeys that you went on through looking at the photos.
A lot of the photos that are available that you can find, I mean, from various sources, but a number of them are publicity pictures, or they're pictures taken for the newspaper. So they're posed. So it isn't just necessarily a spontaneous action that's going on. Some of them are, but a lot of them are people standing in front of the camera specifically for this thing that they're trying to publicize. To me, that is a part of the interest, that it isn't spontaneous, that the photographer said, hey, you, come over here and pose for this picture holding this up. To me, that, even though it may not be 100% true, is of itself very much of that time. Because news photography at that time, the concept was that you were trying to sort of sell something in lots of cases. And so you have a pretty girl in the picture. So if you need to have somebody demonstrating a gas mask, you have it put on a pretty girl. If you have to demonstrate that you're recycling cardboard, you have four pretty girls sit in the back of a big truck that's piled with cardboard. If you are demonstrating that the dairyman's milk delivery truck has a big American flag painted on the sign, you have a pretty girl pose with it. That of itself is a fascinating aspect of the picture, just to be able to look at that and recognize that. You recognize that you're sort of being manipulated, but also it's just something that occurred at that time. That was just normal. That's the way news photographs were taken. So the artificiality of it, on one hand, is sort of amusing and interesting, and yet at the same time, it's very important. What's being demonstrated is super important. The fact that every person in the Hawaiian Islands was given a gas mask, that's because they were afraid that there would be poison gas attacks, which had been part of World War I, and even though they had been internationally outlawed, there was a fear throughout the world during the war that there might be poison gas used. So every civilian in the Hawaiian Islands got a gas mask. And even if the photo of somebody using them is kind of a goofy photo, nonetheless, the subject is really, really powerful. A gas mask is a scary, frightening thing to think that, you know, you might be poisoned or blinded or maimed by poison gas directed against civilians. That's significant.
How about some of the candid photos the families took and the random moments in life?
In some cases, the family photographs or the amateur pictures are just the same as they would be before and after the war. And that's kind of a comforting thought, because you can look at pictures of people having social gatherings, weddings, luaus, dinners, things like that. And it is also, as I said, comforting to know that daily life was in fact going on, that people were enjoying times. They were having good times as well as bad times. That managed to occur during the war, to me, is kind of uplifting. It makes it less horrific.
That life went on.
That life went on, and the Hawaiian Islands were very fortunate that no more active war came here after 1942, because when you look at what happened in so many other places in the world, the unbelievable horrors that people experienced in so many different places that are incomprehensible. The fact that that didn't happen here, and the fact that people did still have children and babies and happy things went on, that, as I said, is comforting to remember that it was like that.
When you look back at all the photos you went through and the photos in your book, is there any one that stands out the most?
Well, there's one that is funny. My mother, as I said, was here during the war. My parents were married in February of 1942. And as with everybody else, my mother volunteered to do all kinds of things because all kinds of organizations were doing voluntary work at that time. So she was, for a time, like a Red Cross volunteer, and she did a variety of things. And because she was very pretty, as I was mentioning earlier, she got posed for news photographs. So there's a picture of her with a sailor and another woman. The sailor has just given blood. And this was right when they developed for the first time a blood bank so that they could have blood ready to go for people who are injured. So this guy's given blood and he's being served a snack because that is building up your blood sugar again and keeping you healthy and so you won't faint after you've been deprived of blood. And so here she is in her Red Cross volunteer uniform and it's a news photograph and I wanted to put it in my book and she said, "Oh, I don't like that picture. My slip is showing." And your slip, I mean, this is a totally 1940s thing. A slip was this undergarment under your skirt, and for your slip to be showing below your skirt was considered like this social, you know, bad gaffe that, you know, how dare you do that? So, of course, she looks at that, and she thinks, oh, my slip is showing. It's terrible. Well, I put it in the book anyway.
Very, very cool. Okay, this is it. You have all the secrets. Whatever else you want to share, now is the time.
Bishop Museum will be doing a small exhibit in commemoration of the 75th anniversary of Pearl Harbor. That's going to open on December 1st. It will be up till March of next year, 2017. A lot of people, of course, will be coming here for the various commemorative events, which will be focused at Pearl Harbor, obviously, for good reason. We're in a very interesting stage now where we have just a handful of survivors left. So the people who personally experienced the Pearl Harbor attack as well as World War II are leaving us very large numbers. So this is the last time we'll be able to hear a number of those personal experiences. And obviously for me, that's a powerful thing to think about. But it's also time passes and this has happened before and it shall happen again. So nonetheless, even though the living people will be leaving us, we will still have the artifacts, we will still have the photos, we still will have the words of many of those people recorded not only electronically but also on paper for us to keep all these memories alive of this really astonishing event and very powerful event and an event of absolutely huge international historical significance that I think is, when I think about it, amazing it occurred right here on the island of Oahu, where I live.
DeSoto Brown, historian at Bishop Museum, Honolulu, thank you so much.
Thank you, and keep remembering Pearl Harbor.
For sure. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from Honolulu, Hawaii.
Support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway. With a focus on rural communities such as Leaper's Fork, not far from Nashville, the Big Backyard journey traverses through Tennessee's southwest quarter down into Alabama's legendary Shoals region, the mothership of American music. The featured rural community's common thread is historic architecture and a timeless, charming small-town atmosphere, some with a river running through it. The diverse attractions of the featured communities include the amazing Elephant Sanctuary in Hohenwald, where retired circus elephants come to retire in peace, and iconic destinations like Northern Alabama's Shoals region, where you'll find one of America's most iconic Frank Lloyd Wright homes and two of America's legendary recording studios that have been etching American soundtracks since the early 1960s. For example, Muscle Shoals Sound Studios in Sheffield, Alabama, opened in 1969 instantly started marking up the charts with number one hits by recording artists like the Rolling Stones, Willie Nelson, Wilson Pickett, Linda Ronstadt, Rod Stewart, and Paul Simon. Nashville's Big Backyard's ardent promoters include Mike Wolff, host of History Channel's American Pickers TV series, who provides a surgical contextual lens focused on Nashville's Big Backyard's diverse initiatives, and Liz McLaurin, president of the Land Trust for Tennessee, an equally passionate supporter of Nashville's Big Backyard's greater good elements through the Land Trust Preservation Initiatives. To learn more about the program, log on to nashvillesbigbackyard.org.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.